Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Amanda, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop and advances in the treatment of lung cancer. And this is a much-awaited program by many of you. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and also lung cancer organizations, including lungcancer.org, Lung Cancer Alliance, Longevity Foundation, Free to Breathe, and then many other cancer organizations. And really, because of that collaboration, we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call over 628 participants on the call, and you come from all of the United States, and many of you from all different regions of this country. And we also have international participants from Algeria, Brazil, France, Italy, Mexico, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really are from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program has been made possible by an independent educational grant from Merck & Company and Helsin Therapeutics U.S., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program and also for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Justin Gaynor. Dr. Gaynor is instructor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, assistant in medicine, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Gaynor is going to address an overview of lung cancer and current standard of care, the role of chemotherapy, radiation oncology, and targeted cancer therapies, the new approaches, including immunotherapy, and the role of precision medicine in informing treatment decisions. Now, it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Gaynor. Dr. Gaynor?
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you to everyone who's organized this telecon. So I thought I could kick things off by first discussing how we think about lung cancer, and really the best place to start would be how we stage lung cancer, because treatment is entirely dependent on someone's stage of disease. And by stage, I mean, what is the distribution? Where are we seeing the cancer? And typically, lung cancer is staged from a stage 1 to stage 4, with stage 1 reflecting the earliest stage of disease to stage 4 disease, which is the most advanced. And we typically think about early stage disease, so stages 1 and 2, as disease that's confined to the lungs, whereas stage 3 disease typically starts to involve the lymph nodes in the center of the chest. We call that the mediastinum. And then stage 4 disease is really advanced stage disease, so the cancer has shown propensity to spread, typically via the bloodstream. So we're seeing disease that has spread outside of the initial location. So that's the first thing that we think about when deciding on treatments. And in general, I think of treatments as really fitting into one of three major categories of sets of tools. The first two I would consider local therapies, so these are focused therapies, and those would be surgery and radiation. And our next speaker will certainly talk a bit about radiation. And then the third major category would be systemic therapies, of which there are many. But these are therapies that are typically given either orally or intravenously. And so these are therapies that go everywhere where the blood goes. So targeting things that we can see, but also things that we can't see. So the major way we think about treating lung cancer based on stage, and this is just to generalize that, in the earliest stages of disease, so stages 1 and 2, we tend to rely more on those local therapies, so either surgery or radiation. At the other end of the spectrum, for advanced stage disease, so disease that has spread outside of the chest, we tend to rely more on these systemic therapies, these whole body therapies. And in the middle, so those stage three cancers, which have spread just to the lymph nodes, we tend to use a combination of those strategies. So typically a combination of these systemic therapies with these local therapies, so trying to use multiple tools at once. So I wanted to spend the remainder of my time really focusing on advanced stage disease, because a lot of the topics that we were hoping to cover are really concentrated in patients with advanced stage disease. So I think the first place to start is really how the management of lung cancer has really been transformed in the last 10 years. And that's because of the recognition that lung cancer isn't just one disease. It's actually multiple different types of diseases. And we've come to learn that those are really based on someone's genetics. So it is now considered a standard of care to do gene testing on someone who has newly diagnosed lung cancer that is metastatic. Now, I always point out that this is not gene testing looking at things that are heritable, so mutations that are passed down from one person to the other. Those are not what we're looking at. We're looking at genetic mutations or changes in the DNA that arose in the cancer. And according to the latest data, it seems that approximately 66% of lung cancers will have a genetic mutation in what we call a driver. That is a mutation that actually led and formed the cancer. The reason why it's so important to do that is that for a subset of people, not everyone, but a subset of patients, we actually have therapies that are targeted. So these are personalized therapies where you're taking a pill-based targeted therapy and matching it with someone's genetic mutation. And some of you may be aware of some of these specific genetic mutations, but I'll just focus on several. These happen to be EGFR, which tends to be found in about 10 to 15% of patients, ALK rearrangements found in about 3 to 5%, and ROS1 found in about 2%. The reason I mention those, because there are FDA-approved therapies for the first two. So these are therapies where your oncologist can write a prescription, and we know that the targeted therapies are superior to chemotherapy in someone who has that particular genetic mutation. So that's not to say, however, that chemotherapy does not have a role in managing lung cancer. I would say that at some point, patients with advanced lung cancer will generally receive chemotherapy, even if you have one of these genetic mutations. But it all depends on at what point. So if someone doesn't have one of these genetic mutations, I would say that chemotherapy has been our backbone of therapy. These are medicines that are typically given intravenously. We usually begin with two different chemotherapy medicines together. We call that a platinum doublet, and occasionally add a third medicine to that. So I would say that is a standard approach in someone who does not have one of these genetic mutations, or after someone has progressed despite the use of the targeted therapy. But I think things are rapidly changing. So the latest form of systemic therapy that has hit the clinic is using immunotherapy. So these are therapies that are targeted not against the cancer itself, but these are therapies that are directed towards a patient's immune system, trying to stimulate the immune system to then recognize and attack the cancer. Now, the concept of immunotherapy has been around for over 100 years, but it's really been in the last 10 years or so where we've really begun to understand how the immune system works best and how we can harness that potential and attack cancer. And we know that the immune system has a series of gas pedals and brakes. You want to pump on the gas when you have an infection and you want to stimulate the immune system, but you need a series of checks and balances. And so the brakes are there to dampen that response. And so what these therapies are, the most common ones or the ones that are in the clinic right now are these PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. And what they do is they actually release one of the brakes on the immune system. And by releasing one of those brakes, you can stimulate the immune system to attack the cancer. So I would say that these therapies are really starting to make their way into the clinic. One of these therapies, called nivolumab, was just approved by the US FDA a little over 2 months ago for a form of squamous cell cancer, and data was recently presented about 3 weeks ago showing similar results in non-squamous cell cancers. So I think the community is very excited about these therapies, and these are therapies that may be useful in people who don't have those genetic mutations that I mentioned at the beginning. So these are therapies that could either be used alone, or trials are ongoing exploring their use in combination with chemotherapy and in combination with targeted therapies. So I think the major questions in the field are at what point we should be using these therapies, and clinical trials addressing that are ongoing. So I think that's how we, an overview of lung cancer today, kind of the 30,000 foot view, and then I'll pass things along to Dr. Besner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gaynor. That was really exceptional and just a really wonderfully clear presentation about lung cancer today and how it's being treated. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Warner-Wasik. Dr. Wasik is Professor Residency Program Director, Department of Radiation Oncology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And Dr. Warner-Wasik is going to address the role of radiation therapy, and how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, managing side effects and pain, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Warner-Wasik.
Thank you very much. I would like to give you all a brief overview of what is radiation therapy and how we use it in lung cancer. Overall, radiation therapy is used very commonly. About 40% or even more of patients with lung cancer at some stage of the disease will need radiation therapy in some form or the other. So maybe since the concept of stages of lung cancer has been introduced so nicely by my previous speaker, I will start with talking about radiation therapy as it relates to particular stages of lung cancer. So in my practice, a common scenario will be a patient with stage 3 lung cancer. So this is the patient who will have a tumor in the lung and evidence of involvement with the tumor of lymph nodes in the mediastinum. And this can be stage 3A or 3B. And usually the standard treatment for such patients would be a combination of systemic therapy. At the moment it will be chemotherapy and radiation therapy, thoracic or chest radiation therapy directed at the tumor in the lung and all the lymph nodes which we know are involved. And we may know about them either based on a CAT scan of the chest or PET CT scan or biopsies of those lymph nodes. So radiation therapy is directed at those lymph nodes every day, Monday through Friday, for 6 weeks or so, sometimes a little longer, but the current thinking now is that it's 6 weeks of daily treatment. The treatments are non-invasive. Radiation therapy is like getting a chest x-ray. The patients lie on the table, usually their arms up, and don't feel that they are receiving radiation therapy. And every day we give a little dose or fraction, and this dose builds up to the full dose, which is measured in gray. And for stage 3, we usually give 60 gray or so. So this is usually well tolerated, although patients are advised that they will likely develop some side effects during radiotherapy, usually in the third or fourth week, such as painful swallowing. We call it esophagitis. That's because the swallowing tube or esophagus lies straight in the middle of the chest and very close to those lymph nodes we have to treat. And that's a self-limiting or temporary side effect, which goes away 10 to 14 days after radiation therapy is completed. Some patients may develop damage to the lung tissue resulting from radiation therapy, particularly if their tumors are large and we have to irradiate a tumor with some amount of normal lung around it, or if the patient's lung function is poor, many times as the result of long-term smoking or other lung conditions. Following completion of such radiotherapy, given concurrently, chemotherapy either once a week or every 3 weeks, patients will commonly receive further chemotherapy, although that depends on their status and what type of chemotherapy was used with radiation. And they need to be followed. The full effect of such treatment on the lymph nodes and the tumor is not apparent right away. It takes several months, commonly 4 to 5 months, to see the maximum shrinkage of the tumor. So as I said, for stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, squamous, large cell carcinoma, these treatments are given once a day. There is a type of lung cancer called small cell lung cancer where we would commonly treat stage 3 with twice daily radiotherapy just for 3 weeks with a shorter and very intense course of radiotherapy. So let's go to stage 1 lung cancer, which we haven't talked much about. Stage 1 lung cancer is this lung cancer, which is only showing as a small, usually small, tumor mass in the lung only without any evidence of lymph node involvement. And this is classically treated with surgery called lobectomy, sometimes with pneumonectomy, rarely. And there is, however, a subgroup of patients who cannot withstand surgery. So if a patient has stage 1 lung cancer and cannot get lobectomy or pneumonectomy, we call such patients medically inoperable. In other words, technically they could have surgery, but they really can't because that would result in too many side effects. And usually this will be patients with very limited lung reserve, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. There may be patients who have advanced heart disease, angina, recent heart attack, and so forth. So fortunately, for several years now, we have a very effective and easy non-invasive option for those patients, something called SBRT or stereotactic body radiotherapy, where we are able to target these small lung tumors with radiation therapy with a very large few daily doses, either 3 daily sessions or 5 daily sessions, sometimes 4, with large dose. We can give a large dose because the tumor is small and we can get away with it. The treatment is very well tolerated, usually without apparent toxicity during therapy, and with excellent result of local control of over 90%. In addition to this stage 1 lung cancer, radiation therapy is very commonly used as palliative treatment, meaning treatment to control symptoms of lung cancer in stage 4 patients, those patients who have disease outside the chest. And very commonly we will treat painful metastasis in the bone or spots of the tumor which traveled from the lung to other parts of the body. Again, radiation therapy is over 75% effective in either decreasing or eliminating pain. So please keep it in mind when you have a spot in the bone which is not responding to narcotic medications or requires increasing doses of narcotic medications. Very commonly, we treat lesions from the tumor in the brain, either with focused stereotactic radiotherapy or with whole brain radiotherapy or with combination, many times also with addition of surgery. And some patients who have so-called oligometastatic disease, meaning they have only tumor in the chest and one or two spots elsewhere in the body, may be considered for somewhat unorthodox treatment when you treat both the chest tumor and the spots in the bone or elsewhere with addition of chemotherapy, which is a mainstay of treatment, obviously. I would like to say a few words about the clinical trials and their role. Frequently we have patients come to our office and ask, well, the doctor, you just presented me with several options how to treat my tumor, but I want the best option. And sometimes it's hard to explain that we don't always know which is the best option. The way we find out is from clinical trials, when we compare a novel treatment, new treatment with being tested, to an old treatment or no treatment at all. And this is done by assigning patients in a randomized or lack of draw way to one of the groups being treated with novel versus old treatment, and then comparing those and following patients closely in a few years, we really find out what the result is. It's a difficult concept to understand, but that's how medical science advances, and I would encourage all of you to discuss whether there are any clinical trials available for you or for your loved one with lung cancer. Communicating with your team, your medical team, is absolutely crucial. If you're able to be seen for lung cancer in the institution which has a multidisciplinary lung cancer clinic, by no means do that, or at least get a second opinion, because it's very simple. If you have three doctors seeing you at the same time in the afternoon and they can communicate right there and look at your, all your images right there, they put their heads together and they brainstorm possible treatment options best for you, and usually when several people talk about treatment, the result is better and more thoughtful. So, but never hesitate to be seen by all specialists which may be potentially involved, the surgeon, medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, to get the full idea of how your particular situation may be treated. And when you have pain, always ask whether radiation therapy is an option. Ask for consultation with palliative care team, if such a team is available in your institution, because they may be just wonderful people who will allow you to optimize your quality of life. And I think we'll be talking more about it at the end of our discussions here. So I think this will conclude my presentations, and at the end I'll be happy to answer more questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Winawasik. That was really just a wonderful presentation, and also just the way you've highlighted the importance of just even scheduling all those appointments together at a similar time so that the doctors can consult with each other, and then you can get the best consultation for your particular type of care. That's so important. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you very much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Joan Hope Elizondo, and Ms. Elizondo is a dietitian. She's adult weight management certified, senior clinical dietitian and outpatient thoracic center, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Elizondo is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. And now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Ms. Elizondo.
Well, thanks so much for having me today. I'm really excited to discuss these nutrition-related concerns and hydration. And so my goal is to try to give y'all some tips on how to manage those side effects of your treatment. And just remember, each person is so unique, and so you need to always discuss with either your dietitian or medical team what is the best fit for you. And, you know, nutrition is just so important, and to keep your weight up and your protein up. So hopefully today I will give you some tips on how to help you through those. First, I want to review some tips for nausea and vomiting. A lot of people have this during their treatment. So you want to try to think about small amounts of food every 2 to 3 hours just to keep something in your stomach. That sometimes helps people with the nausea. And keep dry foods available, things like crackers, toast, or some cereal. Typically, you do want to avoid greasy or spicy foods and things with a strong smell. So cold foods or room temperature foods will help eliminate some of those odors, so that might be a little bit more palatable for you. And also trying some maybe ginger candy, ginger tea, some mints, lemon drops, that might also help with some nausea. Also, a lot of my patients, they have some loss of appetite. They just don't feel like eating. So, and obviously they're not going to eat as much at one time. So again, you want to try small, frequent meals, and you want to think about power packing your foods and getting as much calories and protein in each bite as you possibly can. We'll go through some of those in a second. But some snack ideas would be peanut butter and cracker, cheese and crackers, smoothies, nuts, seeds, things that you can kind of keep at your desk, in your bag, on the go. And you do want to take advantages of the time you're hungry. You want to do your largest meal. If breakfast is your best meal, you want to try to eat a few more bites then. And for some people, doing a little activity, walking or something before each meal and each snack might help with your appetite. So because of some of these side effects like the nausea, loss of appetite, taste changes, those types of things, you may lose weight. So again, you want to try to do high-calorie, high-protein foods. And don't only think about calories. Also, make sure that you have some protein just to help keep that muscle mass that you still have there. Some high-calorie foods to think about would be honey, dried fruits, olive or canola oil, avocados, maybe some of the liquid nutrition supplements like Boost or Ensure. High-protein foods would be turkey, chicken, fish, eggs, your dairy foods like milk, yogurt, cottage cheese, tofu, nuts, seeds, peanut butter, beans. So those are some things to kind of keep on hand. Another side effect, you may have some diarrhea, so you want to try to get adequate fluids. You're going to lose a lot of sodium and potassium when you have diarrhea, so you want to make sure that you try to replace those things either by maybe like Pedialyte or some G2 or, you know, maybe even doing some to get some sodium, maybe some pretzels or crackers, maybe some potatoes or bananas, potatoes without the skin, bananas for some potassium. You want to avoid some of the high-fat foods like fried foods, greasy foods, cream, cakes, cookies, and you also want to limit your fiber intake. So doing maybe like white breads and white rice. I know it's the opposite of what we normally tell people, but that's some of the things that we recommend. And also maybe avoiding alcohol, caffeine, spicy foods, and hot foods because that may cause things to move more rapidly in your intestines. So we want to kind of slow those things down. On the opposite spectrum, some people may have constipation, maybe due to some of the pain medicines or chemotherapy. So really trying to make sure you get the fiber in your diet, making sure you get the fluids, your adequate fluids. Again, also keeping maybe some cereals, maybe a high-fiber cereal like Raisin Bran or Fiber One, doing your whole grains like whole grain bread, quinoa, barley, brown rice, and trying to get at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And as we mentioned earlier, also some of the side effects would be swallow problems. So you want to adjust, you're going to have to adjust the textures of your food. So you might have to do moisture foods, maybe even liquefy your foods, doing some liquid supplements. You may even want to try drinking everything through a straw to bypass the pain that you may have in your mouth if that's a problem. So, of course, you want to work with your dietitian and medical team to see how they can change your diet or manipulate your diet to get those calories and protein in. And lastly, I want to talk a little bit about hydration. So everybody always thinks about, okay, water, of course, is the best hydration, but your fluids can also encompass juice, milk, smoothies, soups, sports drinks, ice cream, popsicles. So it's all of those things. So just making sure you keep hydrated. And this will also help prevent fatigue, prevent dehydration, and also prevent constipation. Now, of course, I will be available at the end for any questions, so thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Elizondo. That was really excellent. I have to say you've given lots of tips to people and really covered a really wide spectrum of areas that are so important. So thank you. I know there are questions coming in now on the live chat, so we are getting questions, and there's one for you as well sitting right here. So as soon as the call, we're ready to take questions. We have questions for you. Thank you. And our next speaker is Donna Wilson. And Ms. Wilson is a clinical nurse specialist. She's a pulmonary clinical nurse specialist, fitness coordinator, integrative medicine center, and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Ms. Wilson is going to talk about activity concerns and tips. And it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Ms. Wilson, who really is just a wonder on these calls in terms of her tagline, which you're going to hear from her better that she says it than I. But I have it kind of on my desk, highly placed, so I remember to do these things all the time. So, Donna, I turn this over to you now.
Well, thank you so much, Carolyn. And it's a pleasure to be on this phone call. I am a nurse and a personal trainer and feel very strong about working with people and making them feel better. I think the most important I think I can tell you is that it doesn't matter at what stage that you have lung cancer, but it doesn't matter if you're a patient now, you're doing during treatment or after treatment, regardless of the stage of disease, you really need to move. You do not limit your physical activity. Before I go any further, the most important thing to understand about your breathing is you breathe because of the muscles of your chest wall. So your diaphragm is a really large muscle for breathing. So you really want to expand that chest wall. If the muscles get very debilitated and weak, you can't have the same chest wall expansion. And you can even go into having something like respiratory muscle fatigue. So it's really important. I can't say it enough to keep moving. I think that when you think about the problems that exist with any kind of cancer treatment, and it goes with anything, whether it's surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation, you get fatigue. You have pain. You might have poor flexibility if you've had radiation or from the surgery. You might get some stiffness in that chest wall. You get muscular weakness. You might increase or decrease your body weight depending on how you're feeling during the chemotherapy. And, of course, that goes with that is anxiety, depression, and stress. And the truth of the matter, all those things to a certain extent can be just changed and you could feel better by keep moving. My tagline is keep moving. I think that, you know, if I talk about exercise and fitness, people go, I'm so tired, I can't do it. But the most important thing is keep moving. Go for a daily walk a day. Go up the stairs. Now, I do know from all the years working with lung patients, stair climbing is not your favorite. But the truth is, if you think about what I'm going to tell you, as you put one foot on the step, breathe out. So that each step you breathe out, to use the power of the breathing out, and the power of your breath is breathing out. You know, we've got lots of guidelines about exercise, and we do know the most important thing, no matter the stage nor at the level of your treatment status, is we know it's safe to move. So what I would suggest is that we try to go and walk at least 30 minutes a day. You don't have to do it all at one time. Do it 10 minutes, 10 minutes, and 10 minutes. Even if it's just walking in your home, standing next to a chair for support and doing knee lifts or doing a chair squat up and down. Anything you can do. I commonly will tell people if you have a stationary bike at home, it's excellent, or a treadmill. You want to stay cardiovascular fit because that really develops as you increase the heart rate. It has good oxygen transport to the rest of your skeletal muscles. So I think that, you know, even sitting, I do classes that I do in a sit position or a standing position, and, you know, get some hand weights and coordinate your pattern of breathing as you're exercising. So what you do is you breathe out when you're lifting the weight or when you're bending over. A little trick to the trade here is that if you're reaching for something, if you're pulling something, or you're bending over, always breathe out when you do that. So when you come up, you know, and you won't feel maybe as dizzy. I think that weight training is extremely important, strength training to improve the upper body strength of your muscles. Try to find a class or try to find a tape to do it, even if it's something that you can do at home. I think that the most important thing is I don't want you to think about the negative barriers against, you know, why you don't exercise. I do get things to people say to me, oh, I'm too busy, or I don't have the willpower. You know, I have so many things to do at home. I have no one to exercise with. But you know what? Those are just excuses. This is your time to put your body in the best physical shape. And the body wants to move. It just responds to movement. So I really truly believe that exercise is a part of our medical treatment. I think that you can even say exercise is medicine. But the most important thing is you've got to keep moving. Really just coordinate your pattern of breathing with each exercise. That is the most important thing that I could have you take away. Because the thing is, if you try to never do any breath holding, because then it'll just make you feel more short of breath. So walking, stair climbing, weight training, even using elastic bands, anything you can do from 10 minutes a day to 30 minutes a day is only going to help decrease that level of fatigue, make you feel stronger, make you enjoy your family more, and make your breathlessness feel much less. So, again, keep moving. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much, Donna, and we're all going to just keep moving. No matter what we move, we're going to keep moving. That's so important, and I know there'll be questions for Donna during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker, and she is our older adult program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services, the role of support groups, and some stress management tips for all of you. So it's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'd like to thank everyone on the call. I think we've gotten a lot of great information today. So as Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. I work with many people who have been diagnosed with lung cancer and their loved ones. We've been talking a lot about treatment, quality of life, managing your care, and I'd like to begin today by speaking about the importance of managing stress as part of your care. So I'm just going to go over a few techniques. In many ways, this is, as Dr. Gaynor had said in his talk, a sort of a 30,000-foot view of this, but these are just some simple things that you can do to reduce stress. The first one I want to begin with is actually checking in with yourself. It's not something we tend to do often, but it's so important. So you want to ask yourself, okay, how am I feeling right now? Am I feeling stressed out? Am I feeling this physically? Am I feeling this emotionally? Our bodies respond to physical and emotional stress by releasing stress hormones, and this affects us physically and emotionally. So we have an increase in blood pressure. Heart rate can go up. Blood sugar levels go up. This also can affect your breathing. So you really want to check in with yourself. Check in with your body. Really listen to your body. It's going to let you know where you are with things. And another practical tip is being aware of your limits. And this really means, again, checking in with your body, checking in with where you are emotionally. Are you feeling okay to do something? Letting yourself say no when people ask you to take on a task that you maybe don't have the time or even the energy to complete because of fatigue. So you really want to give yourself those limits, and really it's honoring yourself in doing that. Next one, getting organized. And I know this is not the easiest. I think we all struggle with this from time to time. But it can help, you know, especially if you're feeling overwhelmed dealing with so many issues happening at once. So calendar, creating a list of tasks, breaking things down, doing one thing at a time, and also really concentrating your efforts on things you can control. A lot of this may feel out of control, so really focusing on some of the things you do have control over. You know, I always point to the example of traffic. You know, we never know what that traffic is going to be like. We may get stuck in traffic. It may be okay. You know, even with the best planning, it can be out of our control. But if you give yourself permission to be a little bit more flexible with it, going to reduce your stress in those stressful situations. I think sometimes the only aspect of the problem we can control is how we react to it. Financial concerns. So this is a big one. For anyone going through this, it is a huge issue that you may be dealing with. If you are having financial issues related to your treatment, related to your care, talk to someone about it. Ask an oncology social worker. Talk to a financial advisor who's familiar with cancer. Talk to your medical team. Because you want to find ways to address these issues. Often if you don't wait to seek financial help, those bills pile up, the debt piles up, collection agencies could get involved, and that, of course, is going to increase your stress. So right off the bat, if you are concerned about financial issues, bring it up. talk to someone about it. And then lastly, asking for help. And I'm going to talk about this more in depth in a minute. But asking, you know, we just talked about asking medical professionals, financial advisors, oncology social workers for help with financial problems. This is just across the board something you can do. Whether you're asking health professionals, family, friends, it's really, I think, a sign of strength. And it can really help alleviate some of the stress in all of this that you aren't doing everything on your own. And then just very, very briefly, some other stress management strategies, exercise, and these are things that I'm assuming your medical team is going over with you. These are sort of the basics, but exercise, sleep, diet, engaging activities you enjoy, whether it's hobbies, clubs, social activities, just continuing to engage in those things that you like can also help reduce some of the stress. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit to talk about cancer care. I'm going to talk about our services and talk about how we can be a part of your journey as you're going through this. A little bit about who we are. We are a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we provide face-to-face in New York, over the phone nationally and online, and that's actually both nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one that we're on today. We can provide practical help. We can help you navigate some of this. We also have some limited financial assistance available. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and as I said before, they're completely free of charge. An oncology social worker really is trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family, his or her support network. We're trained to help patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease. So physical changes, social adjustment, psychological impact, financial demands, we can help address all of these areas. And I find that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. I actually consider it to be treatment, and I'm thinking here of Ms. Wilson talking about exercise is medicine. You know, all of these things, really honoring yourself, addressing each of these things that can help you, it's part of the treatment. And joining a support group, you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. Individual counseling gives you a space that's really yours to voice any of these concerns. And as I said, I consider these to be a part of treatment, and I feel the connections help lessen isolation that often comes when you're diagnosed with cancer or someone you love is diagnosed with cancer. At this time, we are offering a number of support groups, and of course, we offer our individual counseling. If you are interested in any of these services, please go to our website. We have a very comprehensive website that lists our services, also has all of the information on our different workshops, and all of our literature is there. So you definitely visit the website. That is www.cancercare.org. You can also call us on our HOPE line, and that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And, you know, I think today we've learned a lot from this program. There's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. We're here to help you understand what it means for you. Questions you may have about today's program or any of the other things that have been coming up for you, you can call us, and the social workers here really can help you work through some of these issues. I think the main thing I'd like for you to take away from this and to know is that you're not alone. You do not have to walk this path alone. Our services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. That was really wonderful, and wonderful resources for everybody and wonderful tips as well. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So I now am going to ask Amanda to bring all of our speakers on board, and she'll explain to all of you how to ask questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get your question, I'm going to give you details of how to get your questions answered. But let's take the questions first. Let's see if we can get through as many as possible. Amanda?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Well, thank you, and we actually have some questions from people online, so I'm going to start with Robert's question, who asks, and this is for Dr. Gaynor, what is the difference between stage 1 and stage 2 lung cancer? And Dr. Gaynor, if you could just answer that in a general way, and then, of course, Robert, you'll go back to your treating healthcare team, but just to give some guidelines around what that means.
That's a good question. I didn't get into some of the nuance there, but one of the big distinctions between stage 1 and stage 2 lung cancer is basically, or commonly, stage 2 lung cancer, they tend to be either larger or they involve lymph nodes that are within the chest, but not in the middle of the chest. It's just within the lung itself. Those are the two features that commonly distinguish the two.
Excellent. And in terms of the treatment for that, just in general?
Yeah, so the treatment for both, the primary mode of therapy would either be surgical resection in patients who are deemed, you know, surgical candidates. But one distinction would be that patients with stage 2 disease are typically also treated with chemotherapy after surgery, whereas most patients with stage 1 disease, with a couple exceptions, are not.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. And our next question, we actually have two questions for our dietitian. So the first one for Joan is, what are the recommendations regarding appetite stimulants? Are they safe to use while undergoing treatment? So if you could comment on that, and I'll ask others to chime in, but if you would start with that question, that would be helpful.
Okay, well, as far as appetite, you know, typically we try to, you know, do it through food, but some of the appetite stimulants, it really depends, and also it probably depends on the labs as well, because some of them may be, you know, kidney friendly or not, and it also depends on the doctor, what they're comfortable with. So typically we would try to do it food-wise first, but if we just can't do that, then I usually refer to the medical team for either, you know, like Marinol or Megace or some of the other more for appetite. But I would probably go back to your medical team because, you know, some of them may interact with your other medications you're on. So most of the time we rather do it through food, if at all possible.
Excellent. Thank you. And so I'll just ask Dr. Gaynor and if you want to comment on this as well.
Yeah, I would agree with what's already been said, that our preference is always that doing it through food or supplements. But if you know, I think this is one of the most common things we deal with. And the appetite stimulants that were mentioned, and you know, there are several others, Remeron, you know, those are things that you know, they have modest effects. They're not perfect, but they also have, you know, certain medical conditions or drug-drug interactions that we have to be wary of. And so that's why I think it's important to discuss with your individual oncologist, who's aware of your other medical conditions and also aware of what other medicines you're on, before starting something like that.
Excellent. Because food is such a part of our everyday life. Do anyone else, Donna, do you want to comment, or Sarah, just on the kind of any thoughts you have about this as well? Donna, with the keep moving, any implications here in terms of helping with?
You know, it's hard. I think that when you start to move, what happens is you actually improve your appetite. And I think that's one of the things that I have seen with my clients is that, you know, it just, the more they get that interaction, you start taking away the stress and the anxiety, you start feeling a little bit better about yourself because you can do more, you might have more appetite. I mean, it all is intertwined. I think the hard part is to, you know, if you're losing weight, that's the hard one, because the supplements, if, you know, are great, but, you know, they're, it's not the end-all be-all. I do believe eating natural food is much healthier for us. I have had the opposite problem that some of my patients have gained weight. So I really have to get them to move and maybe limit some of their carbs. But on the other hand, I think it's sort of a network of things that between how you feel, your body image, your anxiety level, your stress level, and to improve that by moving, many times their appetites do get better.
And Sarah, do you want to talk about just the social aspect of food? What happens when you can't, and you just don't have an appetite, and everyone's sitting and eating, and you just really don't feel like doing that?
Absolutely. So I think one thing that you can do with this is really not judge yourself, not beat yourself up over it. If that's where you are right now, that's where you are. I think one of the things I hear often from patients is maybe a pressure to eat. So they may not be hungry, they may not be eating, and their loved one is saying, no, you need to eat this. I want you to eat everything on this plate, because they may in turn be concerned that the person isn't eating enough. And I think if you can, if you feel comfortable both for patients and for caregivers, is having an open conversation about that, where you are in terms of appetite, and that there are going to be times where, you know, you may not be able to eat exactly when they want you to and what they want you to, but working together in it, and of course talking to the medical team about it.
And Dr. Warner-Wasik, I'm sorry, did you want to add anything to this as well? Because it's, you know, I'm sure you see patients also who struggle with these issues.
One very common question the patients ask when receiving radiotherapy is what they should eat during radiation therapy. And I usually say what already has been said, well, balanced diet with appropriate amount of protein and so forth. But I also tell patients not to use over-the-counter supplements containing antioxidants. While the science of it may not be very strong, we believe that since radiation therapy delivers damage to tumor tissues through oxidation, if you use antioxidants at the same time, it may decrease the efficacy of radiation therapy. So I commonly ask patients to stop the vitamin supplements, those containing large RDA, recommended daily allowance of vitamins, and also any other supplements, or at least bring them for us to look at the ingredients so we can decide whether they are safe or not. Having said that, I would want to make sure everybody understands that all the antioxidants they can get in regular food, all the blueberries and strawberries you want to eat and avocados are okay. Those are natural sources. I'm only talking about limiting over-the-counter supplements.
That's an excellent point. That's really important. And anything you're doing over-the-counter, to please discuss it with your physicians as well, your oncologist, your radiation oncologist. And that's a very important message that Dr. Warner-Wasik has given. These are really great questions. What a great – we have the whole team here. So now we have another question, actually, for Joan. And it's a question that comes up in all of our calls quite regularly is, what about sugar? I see so many conflicting things about avoiding it completely because it feeds cancer cells versus it's not that bad. Can you address this? I'll probably ask everyone to weigh in on it, but I'll start with you, Joan, if you could say something about the issue of sugar intake during cancer treatment.
Okay, so whenever your body eats, or whenever you eat, you know, a piece of bread, a piece of fruit, any kind of things, your body changes that to glucose or to sugar because that's how your body absorbs it the best. Or even if you didn't eat any, you know, sugar at all, maybe if you just ate meat and fat all day long, your body would still end up changing that to glucose just to go throughout your whole body. So really, glucose or sugar, it kind of goes throughout your body, you know, from your head to your toe. So for example, if you ate, you know, some blueberries, you know, that's going to obviously go throughout. But if you ate a piece of cake or ice cream, that doesn't, your body doesn't decipher, like, this is ice cream, I'm going to go to the cancer cell. These are blueberries, let me go to your quadriceps or whatever. So it doesn't decipher. It kind of goes throughout your body. Would we want you to have, you know, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and, you know, the complex carbohydrates? Absolutely, because they have phytochemicals, antioxidants, your vitamins, your nutrients, fiber, all of those healthy things, and, you know, maybe sugar or I don't know, a piece of chocolate cake doesn't have as many of those nutrients, but, you know, your body doesn't necessarily, like, decipher which one's which. So, you know, you can have, like they say, everything in moderation. You can have cake, you can have ice cream, but I wouldn't make it the majority of your diet.
Dr. Gaynor and Dr. Wernawasik, do you want to weigh in on this as well? Do you want to add anything? Or it's probably a question you get asked a lot as well.
Yeah, I can weigh in. It is a very common question that I get, and I give much the same advice, and that is, you know, a healthy diet, not being overly abundant or in any one facet or overly restrictive in any one facet. As was already pointed out, you know, even if you take in protein, things like that, your body can metabolize those things to sugar. And I think there's a lot of misinformation online. Taking things that are in a lab and trying to translate that directly into the human body, and the human body is much more complex than that. And so I just say moderate diet. I think, you know, sugar in food is fine, and that just not being overly restrictive or overly abundant in any one facet of your diet.
And, you know, our speakers have been really wonderful. I want to thank them. And I actually want to ask them each if they would just give everybody a takeaway point that they would like you to take away from the call today. So we haven't ended the call yet. We're all still here. But I'd like you to hear from each of them just a takeaway point that they would each recommend that you particularly remember. And, of course, there's lots of other things to remember, too. But so I'm going to start with Dr. Gaynor. If you would just say something that you think is an important takeaway from today's program that people should really keep with them.
Yeah, I think that my major takeaway is that the pace of research is moving so quickly in lung cancer that it's you know, gene testing and clinical trials, you know, these are becoming, gene testing is certainly a standard of care now, and sometimes the best way to access these newer therapies is actually via a clinical trial. And so be open to things like that.
Thank you. And Dr. Maria Wernawasik, a takeaway from everybody from your perspective?
Well, I actually wanted to say the same thing. Be open to clinical trials. Check the clinicaltrials.gov. Site run by the National Cancer Institute, which gives you an overview of what's available. There are names of the contact personnel listed there for each specific study to see whether you may be eligible or not. And don't hesitate to ask for a second opinion. It's your body, it's your unique situation, and there is usually some time, unless it's an urgent case, to ask for more than one physician's opinion what's the best way to proceed.
Excellent. Thank you. That's really wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. And Ms. Elizondo?
So, you know, maintaining your nutrition and hydration is really important, and you always want to stay on top of whatever side effect that you have during your treatment, because I feel the more nausea you get or the more weight loss you have, it's harder to kind of get back to your baseline. So, you know, right when you have the nausea or right when you have the swallow problems or whatever the issue may be, you know, discuss it with your team, meet with a dietitian, whatever you need to do to try to help keep you at your baseline as best you can during the treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Wilson, your tagline, what you'd like to say to everybody?
Well, most importantly, no matter where you are in treatment, whether it's, you know, getting ready for treatment, during treatment, after treatment, just please keep moving and keep exercising, arm circles, very simple things, just to keep the mobility and the flexibility of your chest wall muscles so you breathe better. So keep moving.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Kelly, your takeaway point and for everybody on the call.
Yeah, my takeaway point, and I had said this when I spoke, is really that you're not alone in this. You know, that whatever questions that come up for you, concerns that come up, even if it's just one of those days and you feel like you need to talk, we're here.
you know, you can always call us.
Excellent.
Well, I want to thank our speakers. You have just been an extraordinary team, and you really do represent the multidisciplinary team of that you might be seeing when you actually go for your healthcare visit. I also want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program and that we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to address, first of all, if you had a medical question that you didn't get to ask, I very much recommend for medical questions that you would contact the National Cancer Institute. And their 800 number is 1-800-422-6237. And I'll repeat that, 1-800-422-6237. And you'll be getting these resources at the end of the program as well when we send out the evaluations to all of you. So those are for medically oriented questions. And Dr. Werner-Wasik mentioned their website, which is, in terms of clinical trials, is www.clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, so clinicaltrials.gov. And then if you have any need for Cancer Care's support programs, those free services that we offer from our oncology social workers, either financial or practical assistance, a chance to talk with one of our social workers, a counseling talk with them, one of our support groups, whether it be on the line or on the telephone, for getting more information about our workshops or our publications or our website, do contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. Or again, 1-800-813-4673. And as Ms. Kelly said, most importantly, as we conclude the program today, we don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with lung cancer, with cancer in general, with many of the issues that you may be confronting. You're now part of the Cancer Care family, and do call us. We're here with simply a phone call away. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude the workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.